First of all, I am Jemal Gaven from the University of Mexico. Okay. And I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. I've learned an awful lot about Casimir. I hate to disappoint you because I'm not going to talk very much about Casimir today, but then it is Halloween. Okay. But maybe this can be, I think that you might see possibilities with what I'm going to tell you about today. Okay. Anyway, how paper folds is very, very subtle. Okay. And essentially the subtlety is not to do with the fancy material properties of paper. It's all to do with the fact that it's essentially an unstretchable medium. Okay. Almost everywhere. And I'll give you a good example of this. Okay. We would normally think of origami as rather complicated, but origami is a trivial example of paper folding in a certain sense. Okay. If I take a sheet of paper and I score a curved ridge on it, okay, and I fold along that ridge like this, okay, then one side of the ridge informs how the other will bend. Okay. This is very, very different if the ridge had been a straight line. Okay. Not only that, we see that on one side of the ridge, if the curvature is positive, it's necessarily negative on the other side of this ridge. Okay. So this means that two positively curved sheets of paper cannot come together in a single ridge. For example, if I blow up a paper bag, we find that there are these pleats in the bag along the edges. Okay. But basically, if both are positively, I need to form two defects for them to come together consistently. Okay. Anyway, local constraints generally will imply defects in the surface. Okay. And the simplest local defect, because I like to do things analytically, is a cone. Okay. And I'm going to concentrate in this talk on cones. Okay. So, in some sense, one of the take-home messages of this is that the cone, the conical defect, will organize how the whole sheet folds. So, I will begin with an introduction to a fully non-linear framework that will describe sheets of paper in this approximation, the unstretchability approximation. Okay. I will first review the situation without a constraint. Okay. And for these cones, I will determine the energy spectrum. Okay. I'll demonstrate that under certain circumstances, a highly non-trivial ground state, and there are stable excited states. Okay. I'll address the question of self-contact when the surface presses up against itself. Okay. And then I will look at the stability of these configurations. Okay. This is a rather non-trivial issue, whether they are stable or not. Okay. And I will discuss the possibility of what happens when I take out the center of the cone. Does stability persist or not? Okay. Now, if cones didn't inform us about other geometries, they might be a little bit sort of academic. But actually, we can use them as Lego blocks to construct rather more complicated geometries. In fact, ones which are not flat. Okay, so I will say something about surfaces with constant negative Gaussian curvature. And if I have time, I'll say something about the isometries in these non-flat surfaces. Okay. So if this is not to do directly with Casimir, the framework I will establish does permit one to address the question of membrane-mediated interactions outside the linear regime that's more familiar to most people. So let me begin with reviewing the case of a single component fluid membrane. This is, in some sense, the prototypical bending without any constraints on tangential, any energy penalty associated with tangential deformations. Okay. So on mesoscopic scales, the relevant degrees of freedom are purely geometrical. Okay. So we have a parametrized surface with some patch mapped into three-dimensional space. Okay. And this surface is completely characterized by two geometrical tensors. Okay. There's the metric tensor, which tells us the distances on this surface, which is the inner product of the tangent vectors. Okay. So I'm going to use tangent vectors, which are the tangents to the parameterized curves on this surface. Okay. And there'll be a corresponding normal vector to the surface. So the metric completely characterizes the intrinsic geometry of the surface. Okay. The other tensor that's relevant for bending It's the extrinsic curvature, and it tells us how fast normal vectors rotate as we move along the surface. Okay, so it's the derivative of the normal along the beat parameter direction dotted into the other, to either itself or into the other parameter direction. Okay, and it's a symmetric matrix by construction. Okay. So we want to look at what are the eigenvalues of this. Okay, what are the directions along which curvatures are maximum and minimum. Okay, extrinsic curvature tensor itself is not enough. We have to contract it with the, or fold it into the metric tensor. Okay, and now we can look at the eigenvectors of this matrix called the shape operator. Okay, and because it's a symmetric matrix, we have two real eigenvalues. These are the principal curvatures. Okay. So it's a long story. To make a long story short, the free energy is constructed out of a symmetric scalars constructed with the principal curvatures. Okay. And there are two for a two-dimensional surface. There's the mean curvature, which is the sum of the eigenvalues, and there's the Gaussian curvature, the product of them. Okay. Why I was a little bit worried when I saw in Bob's talk yesterday the difference is because the difference is actually a higher order scalar invariant. Okay, it's actually a square root. If you write it down in terms of the extrinsic curvature, it's a higher order non-perturbative invariant. Okay. So with these, we'll assign an energy to each configuration of the sheet, okay? And for bending, because it should be symmetric, whether we bend one way or the other, we'll say we will take it to be quadratic in the curvatures, okay? There are two curvature quadratics we can construct. There's the mean curvature squared, and there's the integrated Gaussian curvature, okay? The product of the curvatures. However, by the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, this is a topological invariant. So it will only come into play if there are boundaries in the system or if there are interfaces. In other words, where we have one rigidity modulus on one side and another on the other. Okay. Typically, okay, so this is bending energy. Typically, there will be constraints on this system. The area may be fixed. The enclosed volume, if it's a closed membrane, may be fixed. And also, if we want to admit an asymmetry between the two sides of the sheet, we might say that the integrated mean curvature is fixed, or there's a penalty associated with it. Okay. So this simple description is a remarkably good description of fluid membranes, the membranes and biological membranes in all our cells and surrounding the organelles in cells. So how do we accommodate a penalty on tangential deformations? I'm not going to even address this issue, okay? Because continuum modeling is technically very, very difficult. Very little can be done analytically. And besides, there's no agreed model. Engineers and physicists are in violent disagreement over what's a good model. Physicists love the Fockel von Karman equations. Engineers, they have continuum mechanics. So what I'm going to go is straight to this limit where the surface is unstretchable. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to treat the unstretchability as a local constraint. It tells me that the metric is fixed at some initial value. Okay. This is the memory in the system. It remembers where it was. Okay. Because distances are frozen now, the penalty associated with any stretching is going to be infinite. So the shear modulus in the system is going to be infinite. This is very, very different from the fluid membrane idealization. The fluid membrane, there was no energy penalty at all associated with tangential deformations. Now it's going to be infinite. But interestingly enough, these two limits are both geometrical, are purely geometrical. The only degrees of freedom are geometrical. Okay. Of course, if this didn't describe a real system, this would not be a very useful approximation. Okay. But as Lord Rayleigh discovered in the late 18th century, it's a very good approximation for plates, for paper, etc., if the surface is thin, okay? And that's why this is so, is because the energy of penalty associated with bending goes as the cube of the thickness of the sheet, whereas the penalty associated with stretching goes linearly with the thickness of the sheet. Okay? So let me say, tell you some consequences of fixing the metric. Okay? And the most important consequence was identified by Gauss at the turn of the 19th century. Okay? He recognized the fact that the Gaussian curvature, which is constructed extrinsically, is completely determined by the metric. Okay? In fact, he was so surprised he called it as, well, so egregious means something different in English today. His exceptional theorem. Okay? Why is this so? It's because there's an integrability condition on those structure equations I wrote down for the surface, which tells me that the contracted Riemann tensor, the Ricci scalar, is given by this quadratic in the curvature tensor, and that is none other than the determinant of the extrinsic curvature, or the shape operator in two dimensions. Okay? So what does this tell us for a flat surface? For a flat surface, I mean, this, I've changed notation rather brutally here. This G, the Gaussian curvature is zero. This tells me that one or other or both of the curvatures has to vanish. Okay? If the surface is unstretchable, the flat surface must remain flat. Okay? So bending can only occur in one dimension, in one direction at any point. Okay? If it bends in two directions, this implies stretching necessarily. Okay? So we can immediately say from this, because there's a classification of flat surfaces, is that the deformed geometry must either be a cylinder, it's a trivial one, a cone, a little bit less trivial, probably a little, even a less trivial than one imagines. We tend to think of cones as this circular ice cream cone. And more generally, it can be a developable surface. If I fold a sheet of paper arbitrarily, it's neither a cone nor a cylinder, it's a developable surface.
What does the word developable mean?
Well, I'll tell you how if I take a curve, space curve, and I can generate a surface by running out along the tangents to this curve, okay? So it's I left out the word tangent developable. It's developed from the tangents to a space curve, okay? In fact, one can show that this is the generic flat surface, is of this form. Okay. Obviously, a globally deformed surface is certainly not one of these. It's not a cone, it's not a tangent developable. So what's happening is that the forces that one applies to the surface oblige it to fold in more than one direction somewhere, okay? But what we're going to exploit here is the fact that the energy effective way to adjust to these external forces is to confine the regions where stretching occurs within a series of sharp ridges or peaks, okay? These peaks are cone-like. Okay. Funny enough, this subject was only consistently begun to be studied in the 90s. Okay. Mehran the other day in his colloquium mentioned the Ig Nobel Prize. The Ig Nobel Prize for Physics last year was won by Serda and Mahadevan for their study of a related problem to this one. Okay. So how do we generate a cone? An isolated cone from a flat sheet of paper. Here I have a sheet of transparency. Okay, so I poke it into a circular hole. Okay, that's supported on its rim. Okay, one generates a conical singularity at the center of this disc. Okay, this cannot obviously be a circular. One can see that the cone is lifted off lifts off the cup at some point, okay? The important point is this singularity did not exist previously, okay? Its creation requires external forces. Let me say something about cones, okay? So let me take a closed curve on the unit sphere. Okay, I think of the sphere as embedded in three-dimensional space. Okay, the point on this on the sphere can be represented as a unit vector. Okay, centered at the origin. Okay, let S be arc length along this curve. Okay, and R be the center to the apex in this direction. Okay, then this mapping R U of S describes a cone. Okay. Let's look at the length of this cone. Okay, it's not hard to see that the difference between this length and 2 pi is the angle surplus at the apex of this cone. Okay, and the two cones with the same surplus angle, or more usually called deficit angle, are isometric. Okay, so let's try to describe an isometric deformation of a planar disk. If this length is 2 pi, okay, then the surplus is zero. Okay, this tells we can immediately see that the curve has to lie in one hemisphere of the sphere. Okay, the ground state in this case, when there are no external forces, is just a great circle. Okay, we require external forces to generate a non-trivial configuration. Another case of interest is the corner of a paper bag. Okay, corner of a paper bag, there's a deficit angle of a pi. Okay, its ground state, the state of minimum energy, is going to be a circular cone if there are no other constraints on the system. However, if there's a surplus angle, okay, in other words, I take two planar sheets of paper and I glue them together, okay? Now there's no axially symmetric configuration that's consistent with that defect, okay? So there is a non-trivial ground state, okay? What's interesting is that there are also non-trivial excited states and they're stable, okay? And no external forces are necessary for their creation, okay? So how might these be relevant to biology, okay? So there's this algae called Acetabularia, okay, it's a unicellular object, okay, it's famous from experiments done on the demonstration that the nucleus encodes genetic information in the 30s and 40s, okay, so it consists of a base where the nucleus is, a stalk, and a conical cap, and they're huge, they're from half a centimeter to 10 centimeters in size. Okay, so let's imagine we have a growing disk, okay, where the circumferential radius grows proportionally with the geodesic radius. That's the radius along the direction, the geodesic from the center to the circumference. Okay, if R is exactly L, then this disk can be embedded as a planar disk in space. If it's less than L, then it can be embedded as a circular cone. But if R is growing faster than L, okay, if the proportionality exceeds 1, then there is necessarily a surplus angle, and it cannot be axially symmetric. Okay. So this apparently this alga is called a mermaid's wine glass. So in this case, it's not a very good wine glass. Okay. Let me go back to the bending energy, okay, and let's use the information we have about a cone. We plug it into the equation for the mean curvature squared integrated over the area, okay? We can integrate over the radial direction, okay? We find that the bending energy is given by an integral over the geodesic curvature squared of this curve on the unit sphere. SSR claims. Okay. So I've integrated up to the, there's a cutoff I need to associate it, which is of the order of the thickness of the sheet. Okay. And the bending energy depends logarithmically on the size. This is typical of two-dimensional systems. It depends logarithmically on the size and on the cutoff. Okay. Now, we could think that we can vary this to determine the shape of the sheet. Okay. However, a cone is not a critical point of the bending energy if there are no local constraints. Okay. However, a poor man's treatment, but to treat this looks like an Euler elastica.
Excuse me, what is T prime? I don't understand kappa.
T prime. Kappa is the curvature, okay? This T is the tangent. Sorry, it's the tangent to this curve, okay? N is the normal to the. Okay?
I was confused by the prime.
The prime is derivative with respect to arc length. I'm sorry, I didn't define that.
Okay, it's a change of the tangent.
That's right. Think of it, if this had been a curve in a space curve, this would be the Frenet curvature, okay? But the curve now lives on the sphere, so it's not the Frenet curvature. It's the, okay. But it looks a little bit like Euler elastica, but on the sphere, okay? So one can address the problem with this way. One does have to implement an unstretchability condition, okay, by fixing the arc length of this closed curve, okay? So remarkably, this. One can determine the equilibrium this way, but a lot of information is missing. Okay, we have no idea what the stresses are on this sheet. Okay, and it's impossible to determine whether these configurations are stable. Okay, so I will develop a framework which to answer these questions. Anyway, let me provide the results. Okay, so we look at the elastica on the sphere. Okay, with these constraints, and we find that the equilibrium shapes of the cone are completely determined by the surface angle, okay, and the quantum number, okay. For n equal to, there's a twofold symmetry, okay. What may be surprising at first is there are higher symmetry states, okay. There's n equal to 2, 3, 4, etc., okay. That there's no one-fold is a consequence of two factors, that the system has the symmetry, curvature goes to minus curvature, and also The four vertex theorem for plane curves tells us that any closed curve must have at least four critical points in the curvature. And there's an analog of this four curves on the two sphere. Okay? So, if psi is small, there'll be an equilibrium solution without self-contact for all values at n, okay?
No, I'm sorry, I'm trying to keep up with you.
If you, yes?
The action that you assumed was the integral over the curve in kappa squared.
Yes.
And so these shapes are extrema of that.
With the constraint, which is mocking the constraint of unstretchability, with the constraint that the length of these curves is fixed.
Right, but then there's no dynamics associated with the extrinsic curvature integrated over the surface of the cone? Or is that somehow incorporated in this? You're integrating only over the bounding curve, not over the surface.
The dynamics here is motion along this curve, so it's not quite, you mean dynamics? We're talking about statics here.
Energy cost associated with the curvature.
Yes, but we've integrated out because of this form of the, because x is of the form r times u, we reduce the two-dimensional problem to a one-dimensional one.
I see.
Okay? In general, if we were to look at other flat surfaces, a tangent developable, would it be not so simple to reduce it to a one-dimensional problem?
Is this realistic? That is, you would think that if you took a system with a great deal of internal resistance to stress, that it would prefer not to be sharply curved on the inner surfaces, might it?
Well, where it would not be sharply stressed here.
You're paying the penalty at the point at the center, at the apex of the cone.
This is a constraint. We will see that if we relax this constraint, the surface will not want to maintain this. There is a heavy cost In preserving the conical singularity.
No, I meant in the, if you look at the shape on the right,
yes.
Curvature, principal curvature, one principal curvature is zero.
Zero, yes.
The other one is much larger
yes.
than it is in the shape on the left.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no energy cost associated with that large principal curvature. Is that right? If I took a sheet of metal and tried to do this, I would have thought it's much more, there's much more strain in the figure on the right than in the figure on the left.
There is, but it's still, it has, this has a higher energy, but it's a local minimum of energy. Okay?
Oh,
and I would show that.
You're saying okay. It's an extreme of the energy.
It's an extreme of energy. Okay.
But, not, but they're not degenerate. It's higher.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, in some sense, it wasn't obvious to me, first, that there were going to be higher energy extrema, okay? Or certainly that they were, that they would be stable. Okay. So what happens if we create? Well, let me go back. So here I'm taking in these illustrations, I'm taking an excess angle, which is rather dramatic. I'm taking two sheets of paper and gluing them together, okay? So the excess angle is 2 pi, okay? Now, if we increase this a little bit more, obviously, the surface is going to touch. There'll be so-called kissing, okay? So I want to identify these kissing condition now, okay? So beyond this point, the mathematical surfaces, at least at the level of this elastic model, the mathematical surfaces will just pass through each other. The physical surface will touch, and there'll be forces, okay? Body forces operating on the two surfaces coming in contact. Okay, so what are these for the twofold? This critical angle is a little bit greater than 2 pi. Okay, and so forth. For each n, there's a critical value, a kissing value. Okay, the interesting thing is that if psi is greater than 35 in radians, the exact surface angle is greater than this value, then all equilibria touch. Okay. There's no non-self intersecting. Okay. And in fact, then they begin to look like the collars worn by these gentlemen in the Night Watch by Rembrandt. Okay.
Are these numbers determined numerically or analytically?
Well, we have some. They're properties of elliptic functions. Okay.
So they're Gouven numbers.
They're somebody's numbers. They're Muller, whatever. Actually, Martin, who I did this work with, but I'll mention him at the end again. Actually, he did a lot of very nice numerical work. So, one. So let me say something more about self-contact. So here's a surface angle a little bit greater than 2 pi, okay? So it'll be normal forces when they come into contact. Okay. The important point is that where the surfaces come in, here we can imagine that the two surfaces are in contact, the stress in this region will be different from the stress on the free cone. Okay. And so if we want to determine this geometry, one will have to identify the boundary conditions associated with this contact. Okay. And remarkably, it's very, very like the problem of adhesion between fluid membranes. Okay. So instead of having an attractive potential, okay, there'd just be a difference in the stress along the joined region. Okay? So two boundary conditions. The first natural one is the continuity of the tangent planes. Otherwise, there'd be a delta in the curvature, and we'd have an infinite energy associated with it. And the second one is there's a discontinuity in the curvature. And the discontinuity in curvature is proportional to the difference in the tension outside the touching region and inside it. Okay? It's very analogous to the situation in the description of adhesion. Okay? To determine the length of the contact region, one minimizes the resulting energy with respect to the contact length, and one finds an equilibrium shape. Okay. Now, in the analytics, we assume that the minimum shape preserves the symmetry, the twofold symmetry. Okay. But in fact, you can see that this is going to cost energy for the type of reason that Bob just alluded to. Is that if I force this to be flat where they press up against it, I increase the curvature elsewhere. So what actually happens is that the minimum energy configuration breaks this twofold symmetry. That there's actually curvature here. And as we continue this, as we continue increasing the surface angle, we increasing crowding, and one samples higher and higher curvatures. Okay. So now let me look at the energy associated with each of these equilibria. Okay. So I'll look at it for different values of this integer. Okay. First of all, let's look at the twofold. Okay, the twofold energy increases linearly with energy density increases linearly with the surface angle. Okay, actually, funnily enough, it's not monotonic. Okay, at some value, at this value, the surface touches itself, and we have to take into account that the energy associated with the two surfaces coming in contact, there increases rather dramatically the energy. Okay. This red curve represents the touching twofold. Beyond this value, we can see because the threefold is a higher energy, it will remain the ground state. Okay, but at some value, some critical value, I think it's written out 8.27, we find that this curve intersects the energy of the curve for the threefold. Okay, and the threefold becomes the ground state. Okay. So let me try to put a bit of give a little bit of a quantitative understanding of how we arrived at some of these results. And I still haven't talked about what are the stresses, because we are not within this approximation, this elastic approximation, we have no access to what the stresses are, and we cannot judge whether these configurations are stable. So we have to develop a more general, a more robust machinery to do that. Okay. So what I want to do now is I want to identify the geometries that minimize H subject to local constraints, okay, in particular that the metric is fixed. And I want to identify what is the stress associated with a given geometry. Okay. So first of all, I'll treat the problem without a metric constraint, because even that is it's non-trivial on its own. Okay. So first of all, I want to do is look at to determine how the energy changes under a small deformation of the surface. Right? So the important point is that the energy depends on the configuration only through the metric and the extrinsic curvature tensor. And here it's useful to treat them as tensors. Don't try to write them down in terms of the principal curvatures, because the principal curvatures transform in a very horribly non-linear way in terms of delta x. Okay. In turn, we know that the metric and the extrinsic curvature depend on x in this way. The metric is the inner product of the tangent vectors. K tells us how fast the normal is rotating. And I'm going to include the definitions of the tangents, the normal, etc. Okay. So what I want to do is to determine how H responds to this deformation of the surface. One can do things by brute force. Okay. And even for a soap film, but the energy is the area, this is a non-trivial calculation. A fluid membrane, it's rather tedious. But there's a very efficient way is to do this, and it's to treat all of these variables, the embedding functions, the tangents, the normals, the metric, and the extrinsic curvature, as independent variables. Okay. And to construct a constrained Hamiltonian implementing all of these constraints with Lagrange multipliers. Okay. If I introduce a Lagrange multiplier telling me that the tangent vector is what it is, telling me that it's normal to the normal, the normals are normalized, the definition of the extrinsic curvature, the definition of the metric tensor. Okay. And what's nice about this is that because of the translational invariance of the system, the configuration variables depend only in the tangency constraint. And there they appear linearly. Okay. So let's look at the Euler-Lagrange derivative of this Hamiltonian with respect to x. We do an integration by parts to peel off the derivative from x. And we find that the Euler-Lagrange derivative is just the covariant derivative of this multiplier f on the surface. Okay. Covariant derivative, because when I turn the derivative this way, it'll hit the square root of the metric tensor inside the area measure. Okay. So in equilibrium, we immediately know that this stress, this I call it a stress, I'm anticipating, this multiplier is conserved. Okay. In fact, this should be the shape equation determining the equilibrium of the sheet. Okay. So I mean, this, we still haven't determined what F is. To determine what F is, we have to look at the other Euler-Lagrange equations. So we look at them in turn. We look, first of all, at the Euler-Lagrange equation for the tangent vectors. This will provide an expression for this F as a linear combination of tangents and normal vectors.
I'm sorry. What happens if you have a global rotation to your system?
The global rotation, there's no problem. I mean, this is rotationally invariant, too.
No, I mean, Vx it will be affected by Vx.
Yes.
Yes. So how do you see it in this equation of motion?
Well, I don't. It doesn't. I see it when I look at. I can write down the equation of motion in terms of the conservation of torques. Okay. But I, to keep this technically simple, I will address it only at the level of conservation of stress. Okay. So anyway, I the Euler-Lagrange equation for E gives me an expansion. The Euler-Lagrange equation for N tells me that the normal component is given in terms of part of the tangential component. The Euler-Lagrange equations for G tell me, identify what I would call a gravitational stress tensor because it's the stress associated with the metric. The Euler-Lagrange equation for the extrinsic curvature gives me another contribution. So in the end, I get this very, very simple expression for the stress tensor. There's a tangential stress, which is sum of the gravitational stress, and an extra bit associated with bending, with extrinsic curvature, extrinsic degrees of freedom. And the normal part is given by the covariant divergence of this Euler-Lagrange derivative. Okay, this is completely general. Okay, if I give you any geometrical Hamiltonian, this is what the stress will be. Also, I can include covariant derivatives of the extrinsic curvature in my energy functional. Now, these are functional derivatives. So the interesting point is here is that the physical stress for is completely determined by the geometry. Once I tell you what the configuration is, I completely determine the stress tensor. What's it look like for a fluid membrane? For a fluid membrane, the energy density is the mean curvature squared, and I'll put in a surface tension term, okay? So I can write this stress as a linear combination of tangents and normals, okay? I find that the tangential stress is the term quadratic in the extrinsic curvature. The normal is given by the gradient of the mean curvature, okay? So this is rather interesting. This tells us that immediately that where the stresses, the principal stresses, tangential stresses are in the same directions. Okay, principal directions of the stress coincide with those of the curvature. Okay, because it's polynomial in the curvature. Okay, and if the normal stresses are associated with gradients in the curvature. So how do we identify the shape equations? What we do is we take the conservation law, the divergence, and we project it onto the normal and the tangential directions. Okay, so the normal projection of the conservation law no longer looks like a divergence, because it's the divergence of the normal component plus a source given by the tangential component of the stress. Okay, so when we project what is a divergence in three dimensions, we get something that no longer looks like a divergence on the surface. Okay, and we plug in these values, we find we get the familiar shape equation. Okay, so it's the Laplacian of the mean curvature plus a cubic in curvature equal to zero. Okay, for people who are more familiar with looking at fluid membranes in the quadratic approximation, in the quadratic approximation, the mean curvature is the Laplacian of a height function. Okay, so this is the bi-Laplacian, okay, of the height function equal to zero. Plus a Laplacian of the height function equal to zero. Okay, so this term here is a non-linear correction without those equations. Okay, and they are very, very important. In fact, the equilibrium shapes of the paper cone are correspond to large deformations of the sheet. Okay, this approximation would not do. Would never be able to probe this region. The interesting thing about this as well is that if we take a look at the tangential deformations of the conservation law, okay, we see that the divergence of the tangential stress plus this is proportional to the normal stress. Okay, but this is an automatically satisfied. This is a consistency condition. And the reason why this is so is because tangential deformations of the surface are just reparameterizations of the surface. Okay, if there are no material degrees of freedom associated living on the surface, or if there are no constraints on the surface. Okay, so we get one would think about it as a Bianchi identity in the context of field theory. Look at a sphere without constraints, or a sphere, the curvature is isotropic, okay? And this in turn implies, well, even if the curvature is isotropic, then the curvature has to be constant, okay? And one can see that the stress, the bending stress for a sphere vanishes, okay? And because K is constant, its normal stress also vanishes. This is not too surprising because bending energy in two dimensions is scale invariant. In fact, it's not only scale invariant, it's conformally invariant. Respect to conformal transformations of three-dimensional space. So that's a quick summary of the situation for the bending of a fluid membrane. What happens if I now implement the constraint? So I will also do this with Lagrange multipliers. So we introduce a new set of multipliers, TAB, okay? And I go through the same machinery, and I find that this adds a correction to the stress. There's a new stress associated with the constraint, okay? And it's purely tangential. Not surprising, because we only fixed the surface, the intrinsic geometry of the surface. If we had fixed some extrinsic geometrical quantity, there would be normal stresses associated with that. Okay? Again, we use the conservation law. We look at its projections. We find that the normal projection is modified. This is the old Euler-Lagrange derivative for bending energy. There's a new source term, which is proportional to the stress. Okay, contracted into the extrinsic curvature tensor. Okay. Now, because of the existence of constraints on the surface, the tangential projection of the conservation law is no longer vacuous. It now tells us that these multipliers have to be conserved individually. Okay. So our full set of Euler-Lagrange equations now are this subject to this. Okay. So one point here is that normally when we look at the bending of a surface, we're changing both the intrinsic and the extrinsic geometry. In this problem, when we bend the surface, in some sense, the changing the configuration corresponds only to a change in the extrinsic geometry. Okay. So how does this work? We now put in the conical ansatz into the shape equation, and we find this equation, okay? I'm going to use the notation that the projections of this tangential stress associated with the constraint along the tangent to the curve and along the radial direction, right? If it's tangent-tangent, it's T parallel, radius-radius, perp, and the off-diagonal is perp. I'll use this notation, okay? The first thing you notice is that the geodesic curvature depends only on the arc length. There's an order dependence here. So immediately obtain a consistency condition that the tangential stress has to be of the form of some function of arc length over the radial length. So we now plug this back in here, and we find this is exactly the Euler-Lagrange equation for Euler elastica on a sphere, okay? And it's, in some sense, in this language, it's quite easy to evaluate because it looks like it can be mapped into the problem of studying a particle in a quartic potential. Okay. Now What we could not do in the pure in the truncation of the problem, treating it as an Euler elastica, we had no access to these equations. We do now. Modulo this, we can solve the conservation laws. We find two other constants of integration. Okay. For a circle, the C must be, if I have a circular disk, C parallel must be a constant. The off-diagonal constant must function of S must vanish. Okay. And we have a very, very simple expression. This term is zero. And the only difference is that the normal stress is a sum of a term which is minus the tangential stress. This is what you'd expect for because of the unstretchability. And there's an extra source term. So what about boundary conditions? Okay. It's quite a complicated story, even though this is just paper. It's actually quite a long story. In fact, it's more complicated than a fluid membrane because of the constraints. Okay. So we want to look at the change in the energy. Now look at the boundary term, which persists in equilibrium when I take a variation of the energy. Okay. So there were two places where partial derivatives existed in the energy previously. One on the tangent vector. One on the relation of on the identification of the tangent with the derivatives of the configuration vector, and one in the definition of the extrinsic curvature. These give rise to two boundary terms. Okay. So in equilibrium for a fluid membrane, this would tell me that the projection of the stress onto the normal to the boundary curve must vanish. Okay. And also, this is in some sense identified with the bending moment associated with the torques on the surface. The projection of this onto the boundary curve also vanishes. These are not the correct boundary conditions for paper. Why? Because the delta x's are not independent for a sheet of paper. They have to be constrained by isometry, the fact that deformations are consistent with unstretchability. Okay? So I solved the at linear order the unstretchability constraint, and I find that the variation as a sum of two terms. One of the terms is a deformation of the cone that keeps it as a cone, that preserves the cone, and the other is a deformation which preserves flatness but turns the cone into a tangent developable surface. Okay, so it's a sum of two terms. Okay. So if I look at the boundary at a fixed R, immediately we reproduce the fact that I anticipated, that the off-diagonal stress vanishes. But it tells us, for more interesting, it tells us what this 1 over R dependence in the radial stress, what it has to be. Okay. And we see this when the dust settles, this is consistent with the fact that there's no stress, there's no total force across the boundary is vanishing. Okay. What about stability? Okay. Now let's imagine we take one of these equilibrium shapes and we deform it into another shape at the same surface. Okay. So now expand the energy, the second order about the cone, in small deformations, phi. So phi here is the normal deformation of surface. Okay. This operator that appears in here, it's fourth order. It's not surprising because bending energy involves second derivatives. Okay, it can be written as the square of this second order operator plus a potential. Okay, in this form, it's manifestly self-adjoint. However, what sort of complicates the analysis is that the potential that appears here is not manifestly positive. Okay. The analysis is further complicated by the fact that these phis aren't not quite independent. Okay, they have to be consistent with isometry. The isometry constraint tells us that the tangential deformation of the surface that goes along with these normal deformations to preserve isometry satisfy this equation. This places an integrability condition on the normal deformation. If we integrate over this, this gives zero. But I know this tells me that the normal deformation has to be orthogonal to the geodesic curvature on the curve. Okay. So one now wants to look at the spectrum of this operator. Okay. So obviously, if lambda 1 were 0, okay, the then all the configurations are stable. Okay. Unfortunately, that is not the constraint, but then we still have to implement this constraint, okay? So let me just tell the upshot of the story. Is this is sort of not terribly, sort of relatively standard, because we had to resort to approximation techniques, okay? The end story is that all of these equilibrium states, as long as they are free of self-contacts, but are stable with respect to deformations preserving the cone. That sounds rather dull, okay? Surprising, perhaps, but sort of in some sense not exciting. What's interesting is that what happens, this is one of these, this is the twofold. What happens if I cut out a circle around the apex, okay? So I go from this configuration to that, okay? So if I cut out the center, this is no longer the ground state. The system actually does relax, okay? So if I had generalized the class of deformations of the surface, I would find that all of these states are in fact unstable. Okay, they're stable into this, which is a tangent developable surface. Okay. So why is this interesting? Okay.
It had such emotionality in that one.
What's that?
It's from T.S. Eliot, isn't it?
Actually, it's not. It's from William Butler Yeats. Okay.
Oh, that's right.
Wash your mouth with soap.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Anyway, whatever it was, it's a great line. So I lost the.
It's
too much emotion. Yeah, totally.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
So, but that's to say that is an inherent instability in that?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. I'll never forget that. Yeats.
Anyway, okay, the reason is because we can use these, glue them together to form rather non-trivial surfaces, okay? So one surface that I'm particularly interested in the moment is in a pseudosphere, which is a surface of constant negative Gaussian curvature. And I want to think of it as sort of a ground state of bending of surface of constant negative Gaussian curvature, okay? So if I start out with a small pseudosphere, the maximum size is going to be set by the curvature. Let's suppose that the curvature is -1, okay? Okay? So it's not hard to see that there's a critical size beyond which the surface cannot be axisymmetric, okay? In polar coordinates, the polar radius grows exponentially with arc length along the meridian of the pseudosphere. Okay. So, at some value, in fact, in this parameterization, at L equal to 0, R is growing. The arc length, is 1. Okay. Beyond that value, the surface cannot be embedded in three-dimensional space. Okay. So if we imagine now we have a surface growing in the same manner as I described the growing cone. It will reach a point where it can no longer grow as an axially symmetrical surface. So how do you have access to this? This is a highly nonlinear problem, but one can use what we've learned about cones to say something about it. Okay? So what we do is we approximate the pseudosphere as a telescope of cones with opening surplus angles. In fact, not cones, but conical annuli with opening surplus angles. Okay. So what we find is that if these had been cones, if the cones had been stable, then the twofold would impose a certain rigidity. But because of this instability, we can go from a twofold to a threefold from the inner to the outer rims of the annulus. Okay, so what this does is we can see that there's an instability towards a cascade of bifurcations, okay? So what we have is we go from a twofold to threefold as the surface grows, okay? Of course, it's going to be horrendously complicated because the surface is typically going to touch itself, okay? But it gives us some idea of how they grow. And this is the kind of thing one sees in the growth of lettuce leaves or in many, many, many biological systems. Okay? So this is one approach, potentially useful approach to get a handle on this kind of problem. Okay. By the way, this resultant geometry is consistent with a theorem by Hilbert, which says that any complete surface of constant negative Gaussian curvature cannot be embedded in three-dimensional space. Okay, because what happens is this surface is highly singular as it grows. In fact, it'll become space-filling. We try to continue us indefinitely. Let me end. Okay, so I hope I've shown you that there's some interesting new behavior associated with the bending of surfaces when there are local constraints on its geometry. In this case, that the metric is fixed. Okay. What we learn about cones is useful for understanding other more general morphologies. And my hope is that this is relevant to the study of biological membranes. Certainly, it's maybe a very brutal approximation to the study of viral capsids. Certainly, it tells us something about plant morphologies. Okay, so as you can see, that this is technically rather non-trivial, even at this classical level. So the challenge for you guys would be to look at fluctuations with these constraints. Okay, but the papers on this are all available on the archive. Okay, my co-workers were mainly Martin Muller, but Martin Benamara at École Normale. Martin escaped today for a Halloween party in San Francisco. Earlier work on this was done with Ricardo Capavilla in Mexico, Marcus de Cerno, who is now at Carnegie Mellon, and with my student, who spotted a blunder in one of my calculations, Pablo Vasquez. Thank you.
So if we wanted to pick up on the biological thing, which we're always supposed to do, the qualitative difference, the membranes, biological membranes have all the flow properties, and the viral ones exactly do not.
Yes.
So that distinction that you're making for those two cases actually comes to a focus on those two kinds of systems. And that's probably why viruses end up with such
that's
structures and
that's
membranes
right.
morph into so many different forms.
Yes.
So is there a way to sort of go backwards and look at these non-lamellar phases of lipids, maybe, or these fancy cubic connected phases, and maybe get some clues about what energies count and don't count?
Well, certainly this formalism can be applied to look at this kind of problem, but I suppose there aren't enough hands on the problem. Okay, to look at these problems in the full nonlinear theory is very involved technically. Okay, I myself I'm constrained by my calculational limitations. Okay, so if anybody wants to get involved, I'd be delighted.
No, I just think there are data around.
Sure.
Might be a way to get numbers into it. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'll never make a mistake again. My wife gave me a copy of The Wasteland for Christmas, which was Eliot's notes, which end up like 18 times longer than the poem itself. So I had that on my mind. Maybe it all.
Well, I suppose there is a similarity. I think it's a line from No Second Troy, I believe, and it's one of Yeats's bleaker poems.
As
he aged, he certainly became more bleak, and he became more like Eliot, I suppose.
Great.